Good afternoon, brethren. Hope everybody's doing well. So, Asher and I have been reading together at night. We should probably do that more often. But we're slowly making our way through through Genesis, and we've finally gotten to the story of Joseph. And I haven't really read that in a while. And it reminded me of what an interesting character Joseph is, or was. And that there was a lot that I learned, or can learn, from reviewing his example. So today, we're just going to do a survey of the life of Joseph and try and glean what we can learn, the lessons from his life. And to start off, we need to remember that Joseph was a real person. It's very easy, in my mind, to sort of view a lot of the characters in the Bible as almost mythic. But the reality was, they were human beings just like us. They interacted with God apparently different than we do, but they were human beings, and they had feelings, they had emotions. When things happened to them, they would have reacted, and we need to understand that. But to really understand Joseph's story, we've got to first start with his family and his parents. First, there was Jacob. The story of Joseph kind of starts off, we meet Jacob running away from his home in Canaan because he had just cheated his brother out of his father's blessing and found out that his brother was intent on killing him. He had pretty much said, as soon as dad's dead, you are too. So Jacob was hightailing it out of Canaan, and he's running away to his uncle's house in Syria. That was far enough away that he figured, Esau won't get me there. And he was going to seek refuge there. So we'll start off, but let's turn back to Genesis 29. We're going to be in Genesis the entire sermon. We'll start off in Genesis 29, and we'll read verses 16 through 20. It says, "Now Laban had two daughters." Laban is the uncle of Jacob. "Had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were..." It says delicate, but if you read the real meaning, it says weak. "But Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. Now Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, 'I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter.' And Laban said, 'It's better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me.' So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed but a few days to him because of the love he had for her." Real love story. You know, as soon as Jacob gets up there to his uncle's, he's smitten. He's smitten bad. So much that he's willing to work for 7 years as payment for her. And that's a pretty big commitment. And he's so head over heels over that he says it passed by like it was just a few days. It was more than worth it in his mind. So everything seems great at this point. But we need to remember that Jacob's family is probably one of the most dysfunctional families that you will ever encounter. So things are not going to keep going well. We know a lot of the story. We're going to drop down to verse 21. And it says, "Then Jacob said to Laban, 'Give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go into her.' And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. Now it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. And Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, 'What is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why have you deceived me?'" So there it comes. And Jacob was quite a swindler himself. We see that it ran in the family, because Jacob just got swindled. Instead of getting Rachel, who he was trying to get for his wife, he gets weak eyes, Leah. He was not happy about this. You know, how Jacob didn't realize until morning that it was Leah instead of Rachel makes one wonder if there might have been some alcohol at the feast. Just speculation, pure speculation. But keep in mind that Leah was not the beautiful one. So, you know, Jacob was not very happy. This is going to lead to a lot of bad things in Jacob's life. But we'll read the rest of the story. We'll read the next four verses. It says, "And Laban said, it must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week, and we will give you this one also for the service, which you will serve with me another 7 years. Then Jacob did so and fulfilled her week, so he gave him his daughter Rachel as a wife also. And Laban gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maid. Then Jacob also went into Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban still another 7 years." So after a little bit more negotiations, Jacob finally gets to marry Rachel. But now he's married to two women, two sisters. That is a recipe for a disaster. Can you imagine that? Sisters have a tendency to be competitive. You know, and I really feel bad for Leah in this entire story. Leah has not been able to attract any suitors to marry her. It says that she wasn't apparently very attractive. So her dad tricks someone into marrying her. And now she knows her little sister is the pretty one, and they have to share the same husband. This led to the sisters competing with each other. And Leah was able to have children. Rachel wasn't. So they upped the stakes. Rachel gives Jacob her handmaid and says, hey, have children through her. So now Jacob has three wives. He has two children with her. Then Leah does the exact same thing. So Jacob's up to four wives. Then Leah has some more kids. And then finally, Rachel was able to have a child. Let's turn to Genesis 30 and verses 22, and we'll read through 24. It says, "Then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb, and she conceived and bore a son, and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son." You know, finally, Rachel has Joseph. But this is the family that Joseph is born into. It would have been incredibly dysfunctional. It was incredibly dysfunctional as we read on. So if we drop down to verse 25, it gives us some interesting information. So they're all living, keep in mind, they're all living right now at Uncle Laban's house. You know, Jacob's family's getting pretty big. They're all there. And in verse 25 it says, "And it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, send me away that I may go to my own place and to my country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go, for you know my service which I have done for you. Then Laban said to him, please stay if I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. Then he said, name your wages and I will give it to you." So once Joseph is born, Jacob actually wants to leave. He wants to go back home. He wants to go to Canaan again. But Laban doesn't want him to go because Laban realizes that he's being blessed because of Jacob. So they work out a deal. They are both swindlers. They both are trying to cheat each other. The entire time, you read the next chapter, I'm not going to do it, but they're both trying to cheat each other out of everything. And ultimately, Jacob apparently was a better cheat than Laban was, because he managed to get a lot of Laban's wealth. Enough that Laban and his sons were no longer really on friendly terms with Jacob. You know, you really have to cheat some people out of things before, you know, the family turns on you. But that's exactly what he did. If we drop down to verse 43, it says, Genesis 30, verse 43, "Thus the man," that being Jacob, "became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what our father's, he has acquired all his wealth. And Jacob saw that the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you." You know, very conveniently, God steps in at this point and tells Jacob, it's time to go home now. And Jacob was in no mood to argue. He saw where things stood. He knew that things weren't going to be very good for him. Now, Joseph would have been a young boy, but he probably would have been old enough to remember some of this stuff, especially the trip that follows. It probably would have been a very, very traumatic trip. Doesn't say exactly how long everything occurred. We know that, you know, it was a long enough time for Jacob to swindle Laban out of pretty much all of his wealth. So it would have been several years, but it wouldn't have been, he wouldn't have been 17 yet, because we'll find out later on that that age is important to him. But we're going to drop down to verse 17 of chapter 31. And it says, "Then Jacob rose and set his sons and wives on camels, and he carried away all his livestock and all his possessions which he had gained and acquired the livestock which he had gained at Paddan Aram to go to his father Isaac in the land of Jacob. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were in her father's, that were her father's. And Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban, the Syrian, in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all he had. He arose and crossed the river and headed towards the mountains of Gilead." Now, you're a young boy. You've lived your entire life at Uncle Laban's house. And all of a sudden, one day, your dad and your mom are quickly packing up everything that you have ever, that everything that the entire family has, and they are not doing this in a very, you know, calm manner. It says they're fleeing. They're doing this really quick, and they are actively trying to get out of there as quick as possible so that Uncle Laban doesn't find out that they are leaving. They were sneaking away from home. He would have seen that. He would have picked up on all the emotions that were going on with the family. And if we drop to verse 22, it tells us, "And Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled." So they got a 3-day head start, but that wasn't enough. Because in 23, "Then he took his brethren with him and pursued him for 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. But God had come to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night and said to him, 'Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad.'" If we drop down to verse 29, Laban says something that's very revealing. Laban is talking to Jacob, and he said, "It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad.'" You know, Laban finds out that they've left, and he collects the kinsfolk. And they were not coming to wish Jacob goodbye. He's put together a posse that's going to try and hunt them down. But God intervenes. God warns Laban to leave Jacob alone. Joseph would have seen this. Joseph would have seen, hey, there's Grandpa. And he's got a whole bunch of guys, and they don't look happy. And he would have seen that his mom and dad would have been very nervous when they saw that Laban's group had finally caught up to them. He would have heard his grandfather probably threatening the entire family. And he would have understood that had it not been for God's intervention that day, probably would have been a day of horror for him. That would have been one of his young experiences. But that trip wasn't over yet. You know, that trip would have continued to be very traumatic for a young child, for young Joseph. Because Laban was one concern of Jacob, but Jacob had a habit of angering quite a few people. He still had to contend with Esau, who had threatened to kill him the last time he left Canaan. Let's go to chapter 32. Genesis chapter 32, and we're going to start in verse 3. Says, "Then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, 'Speak thus to my lord Esau. Thus your servant Jacob says, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight.' Then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, 'We came to your brother Esau, and he also is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him.' So Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. And he said, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the other company which is left will escape. You know, Jacob's worst fear was probably coming to pass here. He had sent messengers. He was trying to butter Esau up, and it apparently wasn't working because now he finds out Esau's coming with 400 men. 400 men at this time is a large army, a very large army. It doesn't say how many men Jacob had with him, but it wasn't anywhere close to 100 even. And I don't believe that Esau really intended this as anything other than an army to wipe Jacob out. I think that's how Jacob understood it as well. And Joseph would have seen this. Joseph would have seen that his dad was scared. I don't think Jacob hid that. Let's go down to chapter 33. We'll start in verse 1. It says, now Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And he put the maidservants and their children in the front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last. You know, Joseph and his brothers would have also seen where Joseph stood in the pecking order of the family here. You know, if you were Dan, Naphtali, Gad, or Asher, you were in the front lines. The thinking clearly being here that you were the most expendable children. And behind them were Leah and her kids. You know, you were definitely considered a little bit better. And then finally, there was Rachel and precious little Joseph. You know, this would have been crystal clear to the entire family. We drop down to verse 4. It says, but Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. You know, I believe that Joseph would have again perceived that God had intervened here and preserved his family by softening, you know, Uncle Esau's heart towards the family. You know, Joseph at that very young age would have been learning that God could be trusted and relied upon, even when everything else seemed to indicate the contrary. Joseph also experienced great loss at a young age. If we turn back to chapter 35, I'm going to read starting in verse 16. It says, then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little distance to Ephrath, Rachel travailed in childbirth, and she had hard labor. Now it came to pass that when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said to her, do not fear, you will have this son also. And so it was, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. So we're not told how old Joseph would have been again. He's probably in his teens at this point. But his mom dies. Her grave wasn't even near where they were living because she died on the way to where they were moving. The only good thing that came out of this was he now had a full brother in Benjamin that he probably felt a very close bond to. We know that he felt a very close bond to based off of things that happened later on in his life. That would have probably been the only brother that he was close to. His other brothers hate him by this point. Let's go to chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37, we're going to read start in verse 2. This is the genealogy of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. You know, it specifically says that his brothers hated him because they knew their dad loved him more than them. It also didn't help that Joseph was tattletaling on some of them. I mean, I'm sure that didn't go over very well. And that he got special treatment. He got the fancy clothes. And then God gave him something that made them jealous as well. In verse 5 of chapter 37, it says, "Now Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more because of this dream. So he said to them, 'Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood up, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf.' And his brothers said to him, 'Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?' So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, 'Look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me.' So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, 'What is this dream that you have had? Shall your mother and I, your brothers indeed, come and bow down to the earth?' And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind." You know, Joseph didn't win his brothers over by telling them the dreams that he had. Everyone in his family understood the meaning of those dreams. And his brothers were very jealous of the dreams. They hated him all the more. They could see that Joseph might rule over them. They were like, yeah, Dad's probably going to give everything to him. But these dreams were going to be necessary to provide Joseph the hope that he would need through what he was about to experience next. So we're going to drop down to verse 12. Genesis 37:12, and it says, "Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Are not your brothers feeding the flocks in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them.' So he said to them, 'Here I am.' So he sends Joseph off to find his brothers. And we drop down to verse 18, and it says, 'Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, 'Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him, but we shall see what becomes of his dreams.' But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, 'Let us not kill him.'" So, as soon as they see him, they hate him so bad that as soon as they see him, he's way far away, but they recognize him. They're like, "We've had enough of him. Let's see what his dreams become of now if we kill him." Thankfully, Reuben intervenes. Reuben didn't want that to happen. But he doesn't totally deliver him. If we drop down to verse 26, it tells us, "So Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh.' And his brothers listened." So Judah comes up with a plan that they should sell him because, hey, you know, he is our brother. And we can make some profit on this. So that's what they do. And Joseph is taken to Egypt. This also gives us some information that helps us to date when this took place. You know, in the old kingdom of Egypt, records tell us that slaves sold for roughly 10 to 15 shekels. In the Middle Kingdom, slaves sold for an average of 20 shekels. And in the New Kingdom, they sold for between 30 and 40 shekels. So it telling us here that he was sold for 20 shekels would have clearly placed him in the Middle Kingdom of Egypt, which was roughly between 2000 and 1600 BC. And this fits the timeline that the Bible gives us for Joseph, which would have been that he entered Egypt sometime around 1876 BC. And that's based on the number of years that the Bible tells us was between him entering Egypt and the Exodus, and between the Exodus and the reign of Solomon. And according to the current understanding of chronology, would have been probably the reign of Pharaoh Sesostris II. If we drop down to chapter 39 now, verse 1 tells us, Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. So Joseph is sold as a slave to Potiphar, the captain of Pharaoh's guard. You know, there's a lot of this story would lead us to believe that this definitely occurred in the 12th dynasty of Egypt. Again, we have records from that dynasty, which would have been that time period, that show that it was not uncommon at that time for non-Egyptians, they called them Asiatics, to be household slaves in Egyptian elite households. But becoming a slave would have been a huge setback for Joseph. You know, he probably would have taken it to heart that it was his own brothers that had sold him. That had to hurt. And he would have found himself in very unfamiliar environs. I mean, he was a shepherd. They lived in tents. They moved around a lot. This was a house. This is a big house, probably. He would have been dealing with an elite household. And the people there would have spoken a different language than he spoke. And he was no longer free to do as he pleased. You know, Joseph could have lost hope at this point, or he could have lost faith in God. It appears that neither happened with Joseph, though. If we read verses 2 through 6 here, it says, "The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house. And all that he had, he put in his hand. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread with which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance." You know, instead, Joseph didn't lose hope. He apparently sets himself to work hard and make the best of the situation, best of a very bad situation. He still put his trust in God, and God was with him. It says God blessed him. God blessed everything that he did. And Potiphar notices that God is with Joseph, and he notices that everything that Joseph is doing seems to turn out right. It would have taken time for Potiphar to notice that at first, though. You know, he didn't just immediately come in and find favor. When he first got there, he wouldn't have even known how to speak Egyptian. That would have taken time. It would have taken time for him to be given chores in which he could prove that he was trustworthy. It would have taken time to develop trust. And Joseph proved that he was the ultimate in trustworthy. So much so that Potiphar doesn't even take a reckoning of what he has anymore. You know, a slave could easily steal things, and slaves had every incentive to steal things and make their own lives a little bit better. Potiphar doesn't worry about that. It says the only thing he knows he has is the food that's brought to him on his table every day. Everything else he's left to Joseph. It would have probably taken a long time to get to that point. But Joseph proves the hard worker, proves honest, proves trustworthy, proves faithful to Potiphar, proves faithful to God as well. But, again, this was not meant to last. We'll read on. I'll read the last sentence of verse 6 again. "And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Now it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, 'Lie with me.' But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you. Because you are his wife, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?' So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her, to lie with her or to be with her." You know, Joseph was proving his integrity here. This would have been a very tough situation. Potiphar's wife was throwing herself at him. It would have been flattering to him. He would have been a young man at this time. It would have been a constant temptation. You know, being that she was a wife of an officer of Pharaoh, it's likely that she was pretty. She probably smelled pretty good. You know, but Joseph did not give in to temptation. He puts her off. And we'll see that it did not go well for him because of that. If we drop down to verse 11, it says, "But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, 'Lie with me.' But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside that she called the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, 'See, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside.' So she kept his garment with her until the master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these." And if we drop down to verse 19, it says, "So it was when his master heard these words, which his wife spoke to him, saying, 'Your servant did to me after this manner,' that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison." Now, this prison would have been a prison run by Potiphar. He was the captain of the king's guard. He ran the prison to some degree. But apparently Potiphar believed his wife. He got very, very angry. He pulled him out of the household. For Joseph, this would have been a very, very tough thing to deal with. You know, he's falsely accused. He's humiliated. He's thrown into jail. But God is still with him, because as a slave, you know, he could have been executed instead of being thrown in jail. That would have probably been a more likely outcome. And again, at this point, you know, he thought being a slave was bad. Being in the prison is much worse than being a slave. Joseph could again have lost hope or lost faith in God. You know, but we'll see that his response to adversity this time was the same as the last time. So drop down to verse 21 of chapter 39. It says, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were there in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper." So again, God is with Joseph. The chief jailer sees that. Sees that he's honest. Sees that he can trust Joseph. You know, that's got to be a rare thing. I mean, if you're a guard of a prisoner, you're a keeper of the prison, the people who you are least likely to trust are probably in that prison, because they're there for some reason, or at least that's the expectation. But even with God giving him favor, Jacob would have had to have worked hard in the prison. He would have had to have been honest to get the jailer to trust him, to basically, you know, improve his situation. You know, he works hard again through the adversity, and the situation gets a little bit better, but it's still prison. He can't go where he wants to go. He can't do anything. He doesn't even have the freedom that he had as a slave. Joseph must have wondered about the dreams that he had when he was younger, because at this point, you know, he is on the bottom totem pole of society. He's lower than the slaves. You can't get any lower than Joseph is, other than being dead. And, you know, prison wasn't a good place to be to stay alive, as we'll see. It's obvious that Joseph really trusted God throughout all of this. And I think that, you know, he had to have been thinking back to those dreams that he had when he was a young man or a teenager. Let's go to Genesis chapter 40, and we're going to read verses 1 through 7. It says, "And it came to pass after these things that the butler and baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard." So in Potiphar's house, in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. "And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them. So they were in custody for a while. Then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, dreamed a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. And Joseph came into them in the morning and looked at them and saw that they were sad. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in the custody of the Lord's house, saying, 'Why do you look sad today?'" You know, it's interesting to see that while Joseph is in prison, he's not lording the little authority that he's been given over anyone put in his charge. Instead, he seems to actually care about them. He's serving them. You know, he goes in the morning and he says, "Hey, guys, you look down. What's wrong?" No, he had a servant's heart even when he was elevated a little bit. So they tell him what's wrong. Verse 8, it says, "And they said to him, 'We each have dreamed a dream, and there is no interpreter of it.' And Joseph said to them, 'Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please.'" So again, Joseph obviously has a close relationship with God throughout all of this. He never, you know, sways from that relationship with God. He makes it clear, and he basically tells him, "Tell me your dreams. God's gonna interpret it for you. I'm close with God." So we continue, and it says, "Then the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, 'Behold, my dream, a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches. It was as though it was budded. Its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. And Joseph said to him, 'This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Now within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler.'" You know, Joseph hears the cupbearer's dream and immediately knows what message God has sent. I'm curious how he did that, but doesn't tell us that. But he knows it. And now he's probably thinking that he knows how God's going to get him out of prison. He's like, "Hey, there's this dream. This guy's a pretty high official. I'm giving him good news." But the story doesn't end there. In verse 14, there was another prisoner. It says, Joseph is talking to the butler. He says, "But remember me when it is well with you. And please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon." Now Joseph obviously is not happy about being in the prison. He doesn't want to be there. He sees this as his ticket out. But the story continues with the chief baker in verse 16. "When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph, 'I also was in my dream, and there I had three white baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket, there were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head.' So Joseph answered and said, 'This is the interpretation of it. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you.' Now it came to pass on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants. Then he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted them." You know, the baker was hoping that his dream would work out similarly, but it didn't. However, Joseph immediately recognizes the message God has sent in the dream, and he tells the baker the bad news. Everything turns out just as he had foretold. But verse 23. It says, "Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." You know, the cupbearer is just so happy to be restored to his job with his old life, and he forgets about Joseph. Joseph would have been very acquainted with suffering while working in prison, and this had to be, you know, a humbling experience. You know, more time, having the expectation of, it's finally going to be over, and then it's not. And we find out it wasn't for a while. Let's go to chapter 41 and verse 1. It says, "Then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream." You know, so this forgetfulness resulted in Joseph being in prison 2 additional years. That's a long time to be in a place that you absolutely hate being, a place of suffering, a place of misery. But that was what Joseph was contending with. And yet, through it all, he keeps being honest. He keeps his integrity. He keeps his relationship and trust in God. So let's read the rest of, we'll go back to verse 1 of chapter 41 again. It says, "Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he stood by the river. And suddenly there came up out of the river 7 cows, fine-looking and fat, and they were fed in a meadow. Then behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the river. And the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 fine-looking and fat cows. So Pharaoh awoke. He slept and dreamed a second time, and suddenly 7 heads of grain came up on one stalk, plump and good. Then behold, 7 thin heads, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them. And the 7 thin heads devoured the 7 plump and full heads. So Pharaoh awoke, and indeed it was a dream. Now it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh." Pharaoh has a dream. It's likely that this Pharaoh was probably Sesostris III. The Pharaoh realizes that this dream is important. We don't know why he realizes that, but he definitely knows that it was important, and he wants to know what it means. Now, at this time, Pharaoh was considered born of the gods, born of the sun god, so they would have viewed this as being a direct message from the gods. And none of the magicians and the wise men of Egypt could interpret the dream. But guess who suddenly remembers Joseph? Let's go to verse 9. "Then the chief butler spoke up to Pharaoh, saying, 'I remember my faults this day. When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me in custody of the house of the captain of the guard, both me and the chief baker, we each dreamed a dream one night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now there was a young Hebrew man with us there, a servant of the captain of the guard. And we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each man he interpreted according to his own dream. And it came to pass, just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me to my office, and he hanged him. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. And he shaved, changed his clothes, and came to Pharaoh.'" You know, it's interesting that when they brought Joseph to Pharaoh, they made him shave. But this was a very common custom of the Egyptians. They did not think much of facial hair. Even the little beards that you see on the bus, a lot of those were fake beards because they didn't really want the hair. So they had a thing with hair, the Egyptians did. So this fits with the Egyptians again. They made him shave because they couldn't come into Pharaoh's presence with facial hair. And then we drop down to verse 15. It says, "And Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'I have dreamed a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it.' So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, 'It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace.'" So then Pharaoh goes and he tells his dream. And if we drop down to verse 25, Joseph says, "Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, 'The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years, and the dreams are one. And the seven thin and ugly cows which came up after them and the seven are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do.'" Again, Joseph ascribes his skill in interpreting the dreams totally to God. He doesn't take any of the credit for himself. Again, we're not told how God gave Joseph the knowledge. It doesn't seem like he went back and slept on it or anything like that, like Daniel did. He just seems to immediately know what the interpretation was. But God gave Joseph the knowledge, and Joseph is sure that God not only gave him the knowledge of the interpretation, but that God provided the dream in the first place. And he attests that before Pharaoh. In verse 29-36, he makes some statements to Pharaoh. Then he's before him. He says, "Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe." And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. Now, therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the seven plentiful years, and let them gather all the food in those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine." So Joseph makes suggestions to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh is pretty impressed with those suggestions, and impressed with Joseph himself. So much so that if we keep reading, verse 37 says, "So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, 'Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God?'" Now, this is an amazing statement for a Pharaoh to make, because Pharaoh was semi-god already, born of a god, and he was supposed to be turned into a god at death. So it's a pretty amazing statement that he recognized in Joseph the Spirit of God. "Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there was no one as discerning and wise as you.'" So he recognized that none of his wise men, none of his magicians figured this out. The dream made sense to him once the interpretation was told. And he says, "You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took a signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen. And he put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had. And they cried out before him, "Bow the knee." So he set him over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh also said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him as wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. You know, this was truly an instant transformation. Joseph woke up that morning an imprisoned slave. And he went to sleep that evening the second most powerful man in the country. That's a stunning, stunning transformation. Keep in mind, this would have also been a big test for Joseph. Power was being given to him. Power often has very corrupting influence. Joseph had been given authority previously, when he was a slave and then as a prisoner. But this was different. You know, he was truly powerful now with virtually no human check on that power. Before, you know, he was in charge of all the other slaves, but there was a check on his power. Potiphar could come in and tell him what he wanted done. Same with the prison. The keeper of the prison could come in and tell him what to do. Couldn't do what he wanted to do. This was like a blank check. He could do whatever he wanted to do. And he gets a wife from one of the most prestigious families of Egypt. And he gets a new name, Zaphnath-Paneah. Now, there's a great deal of debate about what this actually means. I read a lot of articles on that. I don't know exactly what it means. The most convincing interpretation that I came across seems to indicate that there was a mix of a title and a name. The title being overseer, minister of the storehouse of abundance. And then the name being he of the excellent gracious spirit. It's interesting that Pharaoh would have given them those names. It fits with the story, number one, because Pharaoh had basically said that that's what Pharaoh's job was going to be, or what Joseph's job was going to be, and he was giving him that job because he recognized the Spirit of God in him. So, just probably one of the most stunning, you know, change of events that we have in the entire Bible. Let's drop down to verse 46. It says, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. So all this happens when Joseph is 30 years old. And he was taken down to Egypt when he was 17. So that means that Joseph was a slave or a prisoner for 13 years. That's a long time. It's a long time. Verse 47 says, now in the seven plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt and laid up the food in the cities. He laid them up in every city, the food of the field which surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea until he stopped counting, for it was without number. And Joseph's a pretty diligent man. We can see from all the things that he had done previously, he kept an exacting account of this. This was such a blessing of grain to the Egyptians that he can't keep count anymore. It's just too much grain. But he is able to store it up. Let's drop down to verse 53. It says, then the 7 years of plenty which were in the land ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come. As Joseph had said, the famine was in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph, whatever he says to you, do. The famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. So all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all lands. You know, as with everything else that Joseph had done in the past, he was a hard worker. He sets about, in those 7 good years, to do an absolutely enormous task. They had to first build storage facilities that was going to hold all this grain. Then they had to collect the grain, and he had to do this all over a very large country. The Nile's very long. The Delta's very big. That would have required a lot of travel. It says he was traveling over all the land of Egypt. He would have had to build a bureaucracy to execute the plan, officers in every city. It would have been an enormous undertaking, and it was his job. Pharaoh didn't do it. It was Joseph that did it. There's no doubt that God was with him. But Joseph also had to act and would have had to really been extremely busy to get this all set in place so quickly that they could store the amount of grain that was needed for the 7 famine years. Because those 7 famine years weren't just in Egypt. They were in the entire world, it says. It says all countries came to Joseph in Egypt. I don't know how that worked. We know that the Canaanites, you know, could walk down, but how did everybody else get there? We don't know. But it was an enormous undertaking. Let's skip back to verse 50 of chapter 41, though. There's some personal information on Joseph here. It says, "And to Joseph were born two sons before the year of the famine came, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. And the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction." You know, this personal note tells us some additional things about Joseph. First, he never tried to hide who he was. His sons' names are Hebrew. They are not Egyptian. The Egyptians did not look favorably on Hebrews or non-Egyptians. His wife was Egyptian. There would have been a lot of pressure for him to totally assimilate and to try and give his sons Egyptian names. But he didn't do it. And secondly, his sons' names tell us what he's thinking. You know, it gives us a human idea of what's going through his mind. And what was he thinking? Number one, he gives total credit to God for making things better. So he didn't even think about his previous hardship or his family. He didn't want to think about either of those items. He wanted to forget the hardship of those 13 years. He wanted to forget his family. And secondly, God was the one responsible for all the good things that were now occurring in his life. Now, Joseph was not taking credit for any of his success. Instead, he was giving God all the credit, which was where it belonged. But it appears that the power that Joseph was given was not corrupting him. That's a very, very rare thing in humans. Let's go to chapter 42. Genesis chapter 42, we're going to read verses 1 through 5. It says, "When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, 'Why do you look at one another?' And he said, 'Indeed, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there, that we may live and not die.' So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, 'Lest some calamity befall him.' And the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan." So they didn't go down by themselves. There's a lot of Canaanites going down as well. But Jacob is, you know, sending his desperate family, they're running out of food, down to Egypt because Egypt has it. Now this is a great test for Joseph. Remember in the name of Manasseh, Joseph didn't want to remember his family. But God has other plans. Go to verse 6. "Now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth." I don't know if Joseph would have immediately recognized it here, but his dream was just fulfilled, at least the first dream at that point. Joseph saw his brothers, and he recognized them. But he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. Then he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. We're later told that he doesn't speak in their language to them. He speaks Egyptian, and he has an interpreter that talks to them. So he understands what they're saying, but at the same time, he's playing along as if he doesn't. It says, "Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, 'You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land.' And they said to him, 'No, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are one man's sons. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies. But he said to them, No, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land. And then they said, Your servants are 12 brothers, the son of one man in the land of Canaan. And in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more. But Joseph said to them, It is as I spoke to you, saying, You are spies. In this manner you shall be tested by the life of Pharaoh. You shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you, or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. So he put them all together in prison 3 days. You know, these were the very brothers, these 10 brothers that came down, were the very brothers that had thrown him into the pit and later sold him. You know, Benjamin, his full brother, wasn't allowed to leave his dad. He wouldn't have been involved in the actions that caused Joseph to be down there because he would have been too young. And Joseph's main concern at this point seems to have been that he really wants to see Benjamin. That's what he really seems to want out of this at this point. He does throw the brothers into jail for 3 days. He probably wasn't exactly sure what he wanted to do. But he changes his mind, it appears. It says in verse 18, Then Joseph said to them the third day, Do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but you go and carry grain for the famine of your houses. And bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. They said a whole bunch of things then about how they regretted doing things to Joseph. And in verse 23, it says, But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. And he turned himself away from them and wept. Then he returned to them again and talked with them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. So Joseph makes a deal. He decides, you know, I'm only going to keep one of you prisoner, but you got to bring me Benjamin, and I'm going to give you the grain. And he lets the rest go. And he gets to hear them talking in their private, like they're talking to one another. They're saying, hey, this is all because we did this to Joseph. It's bad luck. It's all coming back on us now. They obviously felt guilty. You know, they had not forgotten what they had done to Joseph, and they were blaming all their misfortune on him. And he emotionally can't take it. He has to remove himself. He cries. But it's also interesting, he picks out Simeon, and he has him bound in front of them. And I'm guessing Simeon had been particularly unpleasant to Joseph. The few other accounts of Simeon that we have of him earlier indicate that he was a very violent man. He did some very nasty things. My guess is he probably did some nasty things to Joseph. And Joseph probably decided, of all of you, you deserve this the most, Simeon. But the rest of them go back to Jacob. Now if we drop down to chapter 43, verse 1, it says, Now the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass, when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, Go back and buy us a little food. But Judah spoke to him, saying, The man solemnly warned us, saying, You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. You know, Jacob did not, at all costs, he did not want to send Benjamin. Their food was running low for a long time, and he refused to send Benjamin. Now the food's gone. Now there's a real chance that Benjamin might die just because they don't have any food left. We drop down to verse 15. It says, So the men took that present and Benjamin. He finally concedes and says Benjamin can go. And they took double money in their hands and arose and went down to Egypt, and they stood before Joseph. And when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, Take these men to my home and slaughter an animal and make ready, for these men will dine with me at noon. Let's drop down to verse 26. It says, And when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand. The 10 brothers had brought their present and bowed down before him to the earth. And when he asked them about their well-being and said, Is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke, is he still alive? And they answered, Your servant, our father, is in good health. He is still alive. And they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves. Then he lifted his eyes and he saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. And he said, "Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me?" And he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Now his heart yearned for his brother. So Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. And he went into his chamber and he wept there. He couldn't take the emotion of seeing this brother. He truly loved Benjamin. He may not have loved the other brothers very much, but he loved Benjamin. Then he washed his face and came out, and he restrained himself and said, "Serve the bread." So they set him a place by himself and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians. So it's interesting to note here, the Egyptians, his servants, don't even eat with Joseph because that's an abomination. He's a Hebrew. They're not supposed to eat with him. But then he does. It's interesting. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked in astonishment at one another. Then he took the servings to them from before them. But Benjamin's serving was five times as much as any of theirs. So they drank and were merry with him. You know, this, you know, it's interesting. He does some things that had to make his brothers wonder. They were all, you know, mature men, but there's 10 of them there, or 11 of them there. And he has them seated by age. He knew exactly which brother was in which order. And they noticed that they were set by age, but apparently they were astonished, but they didn't put two and two together to see who they were dealing with yet. But he made very clear that Benjamin was a special one. He gives him five times as much. Not even twice as much. Five times as much. He wanted to make it crystal clear that Benjamin is the special one in this situation. We'll drop down to chapter 44. Read verse 1. And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, "Fill the men's sack with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Also put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his grain money." So he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. As soon as the morning dawned, the men were sent away, and they and their donkeys. And when they had gone out of the city and were not yet far off, Joseph said to his steward, "Get up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid evil for good? Is not the one from which my Lord drinks, and with which he indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing. Is not this the one?'" So he was talking about the cup. So Joseph set something up. He's planted a silver cup in Benjamin's sack of grain. He sends a steward out then. They catch him. And in verse 12, he says, "So he searched and he began with the oldest and left off with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city." This is, all the brothers returned to the city, though. None of them abandoned Benjamin. I don't know if Joseph actually expected that. I think Joseph kind of expected that they might be happy to get rid of Benjamin. Not entirely sure. Then let's read verse 16. It says, "Then Judah said, 'What shall we say, my Lord? What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found.' But he said, 'Far be it from me that I should do so. But the man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. And as for you, go up in peace to your father.'" Now, a lot of commentators that I read seem to think that this was a test of the brothers to see if they'd abandon Joseph or Benjamin. Personally, I think Joseph wanted Benjamin to live with him, and he didn't really care if the other brothers went back home. Let's read verse 18. It says, "Then Judah came near to him, And this is going to be a long section, but it's kind of important. It says, then Judah came near to him and said, O my lord, please let your servant speak a word in my lord's hearing, and do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh. My lord asked his servant, saying, have you a father or a brother? And we said to my lord, we have a father, an old man, and a child of his old age who is young. His brother is dead, and he alone is left in his mother's children, and his father loves him. And if we drop down to verse 32, it says, for your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if you do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father? You know, the second trip to Egypt must have taken until the family was really out of food, because Jacob really wasn't willing to let Benjamin go. Ultimately, he goes, and Joseph... Wait, I am reading the wrong spot. Sorry. You know, Judah steps up at this point, and he lays out the situation. He's telling Joseph to take him instead, because he says, Jacob, my dad, is going to die if I don't bring Benjamin back. And this is too much for Joseph. We read chapter 45, verses 1 through 8. Then Joseph could no longer restrain himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried out, make everyone go from me. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near me. And they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, who sold you into Egypt. They didn't get it the first time. He had to repeat it. But now, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all of his house, and a ruler throughout all of Egypt. Hasten and go up to my father, and say to him, thus says your son, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not tarry. Joseph finally reveals himself to the brothers. And he also at this point has come to terms with what they had done. Maybe he had come to terms with it years ago. I don't know. But he sees God's hand in everything that's been done. He sees that God used their evil intent and his previous misfortunes to get him to where God wanted him to be. This is probably the most important lesson we can learn from Joseph. If only we can look past all of life's problems and misfortunes and see that God's hand is in everything, working to accomplish his own will in our lives. We may just not have our eyes on God's will all the time. Joseph also tells his brother the titles that he has in Egypt. And these titles are known from documents in the Middle Kingdom. And they would have let his brothers know the level of authority that he had. The level of authority that him saying, come down to me, wasn't just an idle, hey, why don't you come on over? He's saying, no, come down, move here. I can make it happen. And he does make it happen. I'm not going to read the rest of the life of Joseph. Basically, he lives a long life. He lives a good life. This was the primary thing. It sets up a lot of things for the rest of the Bible. Joseph was a remarkable man, and we can learn a lot of lessons from him. First, he always trusted God. Even through times where it may have seemed that God wasn't there, Joseph knew that God was. We should learn this lesson. Second, Joseph remained humble and gave credit to God for everything good in his life. It would have been very easy for him to think highly of himself, to think that his work and his effort, which I'm sure he put a lot into, played some role in his elevation. He could have been corrupted by the power, but instead, Joseph remembered that it was God that was deserving of praise and honor. Third, Joseph always put forth his best effort, regardless of the circumstances. When he was made a slave, he decided he would be the best slave that he could be. When he was a prisoner, he tried to be the best prisoner that he could be. And when Pharaoh elevated him and he became a minister in the government, he did his best to be the ultimate administrator. You know, how diligent are we to do our best in every circumstance that we find ourselves in? It's a lesson we can learn from Joseph. And finally, Joseph learned to forgive. He was wronged many times in his life. By the time he was 30 years old, he could have avenged himself of every wrong. But we don't read that he ever did this. In fact, we read that he blessed those that had spitefully mistreated him. Now, Jesus gave us the perfect example of this, but Joseph demonstrated this quality as well. And we know that we must learn to forgive others if we expect to be forgiven our sins by God. There's so much that we can learn from the lessons of Joseph. So remember, Joseph.